From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect Weekend. I'm Joy Powers. Today on the show, we speak with Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes about how the state can move toward racial equity. We learn about Juneteenth Day and have the latest edition of Bubbler Talk. Then a new report looks at the gender wage gap in Milwaukee County, which is closing but persistent.
We compared 2010 to 2018, and we saw that the gap narrowed from women earning 81% of what men earned to 85% during that period.
Plus, how the Milwaukee Public Museum is adapting to a virtual experience due to the coronavirus pandemic.
Yes, it may not be the same in terms of tactile experiences, but I mean, I think that we will always be a museum where there are objects and specimens and things that you wouldn't ordinarily be able to see in front of you, for sure.
Lake Effect Weekend is next, but first, the news. This is Lake Effect Weekend from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Joy Powers. One of the biggest stories slated for Wisconsin in 2020 was the Democratic National Convention. But as we move closer to the convention date, it's one of the last things on the minds of many Wisconsinites, especially Milwaukeeans. People in Milwaukee and throughout the U.S. are continuing to march against police brutality, calling for justice, reforms, and accountability. And these protests, centered on racial inequities, are especially potent in Milwaukee, considered one of the most segregated cities in America. Since the beginning of his career, Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes has focused on racial justice. As a Milwaukee native, Barnes says people here are, quote, stepping up for good reason. He joins Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski to talk about the protests and what it'll take to create statewide reforms.
Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes, welcome to Lake Effect. Thank you for taking some time to speak with me today.
Yeah, thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
So equity was a key point and goal of yours, along with sustainability, right after you and Governor Evers won the election. So in light of recent protests following the death of George Floyd in Minnesota, what are the key issues of equity that need to be addressed right now?
Well, that's the thing. They're the same issues. And addressing equity on the front end prevents things like this from happening. Making sure that communities are properly resourced, making sure that children have the same opportunity in all parts of our state. And that's not the reality right now. And it's certainly not the reality across the United States of America. Otherwise, you wouldn't see the response that you're seeing. And I remind people that the activity, the protest, even some of the more damaging aspects, which was a small minority of it, it's like volcanic activity. People have dealt with these extreme living conditions for far too long. And I think about elected leaders, a lot of people in office, especially our highest offices, who haven't experienced life in folks' shoes and in the shoes of marginalized people, be it poverty or be it color of skin. And so the ability to relate to what's going on isn't there. And that's why you don't see the response that you should be seeing. And I am very frustrated every day that I wake up and have to deal with the inaction of our state legislature, especially on the issues that are as pressing as this, the ones that are, you know, right in the forefront. And to see so many folks across the state of Wisconsin who are stepping up, who are coming out of their homes to protest injustice is something, is a sight to behold. And it's something that makes me very proud, because these are people who probably didn't think that issues of racial justice ever would impact them. And the issues probably still won't impact them, but it's too big to ignore at this point. I saw one person with a sign. I'm not sure if it was here in Wisconsin, but the sign just said, "I finally get it."
And what is the governor's office's role, including yours as lieutenant governor, for pushing for equity? And what's been done or will be done? You mentioned legislatures have yet to really move or make action.
Yeah, so we have to lead with equity in every decision that we make. And even the budget that was introduced was one that established equity in the forefront, and also, you know, sustainability. But that means that, you know, we need to put a little bit more money into early childhood programs, especially in our most challenged zip codes, like the 53206. The governor did that, making sure that we work to create opportunities for people, especially returning citizens, you know, and making the upfront investment so we don't have to spend as much money on incarceration to create job programs and to help small businesses. There's so much, but it's tough to do it on our own. And that's not the way governing is supposed to happen anyway. And people can look at it as divided government, but it should be looked at as shared government. But that's not what we're getting right now. And it's not about what the executive branch is getting. It's what the people of the state are or not getting. And, you know, the time for the partisan political games is long. That should be over with, because these aren't partisan issues. These are issues of life and death for people. And, you know, we're going to keep moving forward with everything we can do as far as executive authority. But there's still so much more that's left to be desired.
On Twitter, you said, quote, "We need to invest more in neighborhoods and community services. The more money we invest in opportunity for people, the less money we have to spend on police and prisons." So does this mean you're in favor of defunding police as a way of reform in policing? Evers has said that he doesn't believe defunding the police will work. But what's your opinion on that stance that people are calling for right now?
I think I made it pretty clear in that message, in that tweet, because the more money that we invest in our schools, the more money we invest in early childhood education, the more we invest in job programs and business creation programs in our most challenged parts of society, the less money we'll have to spend on incarceration, the less money we'll have to spend on policing. It's a conversation about budget prioritization, and we have to promote budgets that put people first. And in putting people first, you effectively work to create safer communities, places where people want to live and where people want to invest and where there is less of a need for police presence. So I think that, you know, my message is very clear there in saying that in saying what we need to do upfront, what the immediate thing needs to be to address the crises that we're facing, to right the wrongs that we're dealing with.
But do you believe that taking money from overinflated police budgets should then be put towards other things in that sense of defunding police?
Well, you can look at City of Milwaukee, for example, where 45% of the departmental allocations that goes to police, while you get, you know, libraries like 2 or 3%, neighborhood services 2 or 3%. You know, I think that you can look at that as a priorities mismatch. I think that if you look for, like, even in the federal government, you look at the bloated military budget. Even in state government, you look at the Department of Corrections budget, and, you know, this is our own administration, right? Like, you know, and this, it didn't start with us, and it's something that we're actively working to remedy. We're working to reduce our prison population. We are very intentional about making that happen, and it takes that intentionality, you know. And it's easy to look at a budget of a police department and say, well, yeah, we are spending a lot of money. How do we get smarter about this? And again, it becomes a conversation about needs. This isn't about attacking the police. If anything, it's about making their jobs easier by implementing programs that where we'd have services where they wouldn't have to respond to things that aren't crimes, where they don't have to respond to instances that would be better suited for a social worker or some sort of crisis intervener or a violence interrupter that would help promote peace in communities in the first place. I think that's where our funding should go, because, you know, what's going on right now isn't necessarily working. You know, police brutality is one thing, but in general, the idea of promoting safer communities, I don't think that we're doing a good job at that. And when I say we, I mean everybody in most offices across the country. There's so much more, and that's why I call on, you know, our local elected officials to think about the priorities. You know, think about what opportunity can mean for the communities and the districts that you represent. Think about what opportunity can mean for this entire state. And, you know, a world that sees much less violence, a world that experiences much more peace and much more harmony and, interconnectivity between neighbors, between, you know, communities, that's possible. You can look at it as some sort of, you know, pie in the sky dream, but it's absolutely possible. I think that the United States is one of the countries that has seen the most trouble because, you know, from our founding, it was a violent founding, and it only makes sense that there is still violence all these years later, 300 years later, and we could be far better off. But it takes imagining, it takes people challenging their ideas, their perception of what society should look like.
So you are a Milwaukee native, and I'm curious, what was your and has been your personal reaction to the marches that have taken place here and continue to take place here in response to police brutality and a host of other issues?
People are stepping up for good reason. And I think that we have these and the thing about it, too, is, I mean, you just saw somebody get shot in Atlanta just a couple of days ago. But I think that what we're seeing also is a compounded crisis, where we have the pandemic and people are out of work, people aren't going back to school, and people have so many more grievances to be aired. And what COVID-19 did was expose a lot of the fissures, it exposed a lot of the societal flaws that we have, especially amongst race and class. And you see the most impacted people, those who are losing their lives at an inordinate rate. You know, these are Black and brown people, these are low-income individuals. And so when those sorts of societal failures are highlighted, when you have an instance where you have a George Floyd who, you know, died, you know, with his neck under the knee of a police officer while three others looked on, you have an Ahmaud Arbery who was killed by a vigilante while a person followed and filmed the instance, when, you know, and immediately you think this is someone who's trying to, you know, stop this from happening, but that person was a party to the crime. You see a Breonna Taylor who was sleeping in her home, you know, and she couldn't have been farther removed from any sort of crime at all. You know, you see these repeated instances and you sort of ask yourself, you know, how much more can you take? And the bigger question is, you know, why did it take so long for so many folks to ignore it? And like that person signs that I finally get it, I often think about people who haven't necessarily had to think about these things. They haven't had to think about racial injustice. They've gone through childhood, they've gone through school, adult life, and professional life, and they're still learning. And that confuses me, because, you know, you've made it this far in life without ever having to consider the plight of other people. And I think that is a bigger part of the problem, too, is that the issues of racial justice have been way too easy for folks to ignore. You know, and people have gotten pretty far in life without ever having to make those considerations. And, you know, that is a challenge I have for myself. I think about the injustices that many other communities deal with that I don't personally deal with, but I understand it, because as long as this injustice goes on towards, you know, communities, then we're all going to be in a bad place. And that is, and what we've seen over the last couple of weeks is everything coming to a head, and people aren't going to deal with it anymore. It's really a surprise that folks have dealt with it this long.
So in regards to racism as a public health crisis, Milwaukee County leaders declared it a public health crisis back in 2019. And currently we're seeing more city and county leaders across the U.S. officially doing the same. So would you have any plans to move to make it a statewide declaration? Because as you mentioned, most people don't think about it as that way and they don't live that experience. But if the state played a role in declaring it a public health crisis, that could potentially help influence funding and policy.
Yeah, whether formal or not, it's something that I carry around all the time. I talk about issues of racial injustice and how it is a detriment to how it impedes our state's ability to thrive. You know, when I'm in Milwaukee, I find myself talking about number of rural issues. When I'm in more rural areas, I find myself talking about more Milwaukee and diverse issues, because I want to make sure that I'm doing everything I can do to bridge those gaps, to start some conversations, to begin dialogue, to start the process of understanding for people who just may not get it. And there are some well-intentioned people who just don't get it. There are some people who actively don't get it, who try their best to avoid it and will gaslight the American public into thinking that this isn't a real problem. But there are a lot of people who truly want to be better, but just don't know how. I actually received a message from a person in the western part of the state, and I don't know how to respond to it. I don't know how my office is going to respond to it yet, but it's a person who reached out in earnest and said that he has, you know, his own issues that he's dealing with. And, you know, he talked about having this Black neighbor that he used to talk to about these things. And, you know, since then, that neighbor has died. So he said that he doesn't have that outlet anymore. But he feels a certain sense of nervousness around youth of color, right? But he reached out not to say that he thinks they're doing anything wrong. He just doesn't know what to do. He just doesn't know how to approach it. So there are, you know, there are some people like that who legitimately, you know, are looking for, you know, the best way to go about things, who want to do the right thing, but just don't know. And that's a process that, you know, government can't necessarily fix. You know, that's an issue that society has to fix, but in many ways you see society working to fix itself. You know, like I've mentioned before, the people who are standing up to protest, these aren't folks who are showing up because they want things to get worse. They're showing up because they want to save the nation from cascading in a complete and total devastation.
Racial justice has been a focus of your entire career, and the protests that have spread around the world show the reactions of a blatant disregard of Black lives. And you mentioned being not quite sure of how to respond to the person who reached out to you. And there's a lot of fatigue in the Black community that you can personally attest to. So how fatigued are you, and what, if anything, helps you remain hopeful, especially in your role as Lieutenant Governor?
Yeah, and I'll start by saying that, you know, racial justice has been an issue for my entire working life, but there have been so many other issues, right? Like, I think about issues like jobs and economic development, education, you know, prison reform, environmental issues, all those things, right? And addressing one doesn't take any focus or energy away from the other, but it doesn't feel that way when I talk to other people that, you know, you can prioritize your issue, yes, but that doesn't mean disregard the other ones that are going on. It's always like, you know, we'll get to the racial justice one later. We'll get to the racial justice issue. Oh, this isn't the time to talk about that. This isn't the part of the state to talk about that. This isn't the campaign to talk about that. But for a lack of talking about it is why we are where we are now. And the fatigue that does exist, because there definitely is a fatigue, because you feel like you talk about this stuff forever, and I can go back to folks who still, you know, want to be educated, people who've gone on to be very successful in life and now are like crowdsourcing their views on society by leaning on people who've been through the most to educate them about something that they probably could have taken a little more time to pay attention to, but chose not for whatever reason. And, I just want to encourage people to, you know, be better when it comes to that. Think about before you ask your friends of color, before you ask your Black friend, can you help me be better? Like, think about how is it that you got this far without ever having to worry about it, and think about how tired, some of your Black friends could be in a moment such as this, because there's no off switch. A lot of people go home, relax, chill out once this, you know, wake up in the day and they, you know, send some tweets and go to a march, which is great. You know, do everything you can do to, you know, talk to your family. There's so many things that people can do, and I'm not here to admonish anyone for trying. But I do want to remind people that for a lot of leaders who experience and live this daily, whether in elected office or not, it's a bit much. It can be a lot, but we're called to leadership, and you know, this is the work that has to happen, and this is one of the reasons why I got elected, to make sure that we're leading with our best self, that we're doing everything that we can do to build safe, happy, healthy, and inclusive societies, not just here in Wisconsin, but all across the country. I know it's possible, and I think that's sort of what keeps me going, that ridiculous hope, that ridiculous optimism, that things can be better.
Well, and what are you doing to take care of yourself during such demanding times?
I exercise, that helps. Been doing a little bit of yoga, video games here and there, and I eat a lot of food. I eat so much food.
All right. Well, Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes, thank you so much for joining me. I really appreciate your time.
I appreciate it. Thank you for having me.
Mandela Barnes is the Lieutenant Governor of Wisconsin, and he spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski. Coming up, we'll learn about the roots of Juneteenth Day, and Bubbler Talk tracks COVID-19 recovery in Milwaukee. You're listening to Lake Effect Weekend on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect Weekend continues now on WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Friday was Juneteenth, also known as Black Independence Day or Freedom Day. The holiday commemorates the announcement of the official end to slavery in Galveston, Texas in 1865. Wisconsin is one of at least 40 states that observes Juneteenth Day, and Milwaukee was one of the first cities in the North to celebrate it. The city would have been hosting its 49th annual Juneteenth Day festival, but due to the threat of coronavirus in large gatherings, this year's plans had to change. Still, both local and state governments are acknowledging the holiday in ways they haven't before. WUWM's race and ethnicity reporter Taryn Powell has this story on the history of Juneteenth Day and what celebrations will look like.
For many people in the United States, when they mention Independence Day, they're talking about July 4th, which commemorates the Declaration of Independence. But for African Americans, a different date signifies independence, June 19th, 1865. That was 2 years after President Abraham Lincoln signed the Emancipation Proclamation, a document that freed slaves in all states that rebelled against the Union. The date has been referred to as Freedom Day, Black Independence Day, or most commonly, Juneteenth, and it originated in Texas. Cabrera Baumgartner, the assistant professor of American Studies at the University of New Hampshire at Durham, explains.
In April 1865, as the Civil War was coming to an end, Union General Gordon Granger issued a general order in Galveston, Texas, that freed all enslaved African Americans. The order, in Granger's words, declared, quote, an equality of personal rights and rights of property between former masters and slaves. And so this order affirmed equality, rights, and property for African Americans. So it was monumental. And I think at that point, Juneteenth became a prominent celebration in Texas and was celebrated then and continues to be celebrated today on a national scale.
Baumgartner says newspapers described the early Juneteenth celebrations in Texas as freedom celebrations. She shared an excerpt from an 1868 San Antonio Express article titled The Jubilee. It read, "It was a most interesting sight to see so many of those people celebrating their freedom. They came in carriages, buggies, wagons, and on horseback. They were all well-dressed. The women looked neat without any display of finery. Good humor and contentment beamed from every countenance."
It really was just about African Americans hosting a feast or dinner and then a discussion, and then they marched in the streets. So there was sometimes a parade. It was really considered, you know, fun and commemorative celebration.
This year, the typical Juneteenth celebrations in Milwaukee, such as the annual festival, won't look as they have in the past due to the threat of COVID-19. However, organizations are using the day to promote unity and education through a number of events. The plans include marches, voter registration drives, and the sharing of health information, including about the coronavirus. And for the first time in history, the Juneteenth Day flag will fly over Milwaukee City Hall and the State Capitol building in Madison. Taryn Powell, 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Support for race and ethnicity reporting is provided by the Doman Company Foundation.
Bubbler Talk, quenching Milwaukee's thirst for knowledge.
This is WUWM's Chuck Quernbach. Listener Gene Kelber of Shorewood wants to know how many people in Wisconsin have survived a COVID-19 diagnosis. He says he and his wife are in a high-risk age group for the disease.
We're both over 70. We wondered how this is going to impact our life.
Wisconsin statistics indicate statewide 76% of the people with confirmed COVID-19 recover. In Milwaukee County, the percentage is a bit lower, 71. Recovery means there's documentation of resolved symptoms, of release from public health isolation, or 30 days since symptom onset or diagnosis. With about 24,000 COVID cases in Wisconsin, that means about 18,000 people have recovered. Dr. Ryan Westergaard is Chief Medical Officer of the State Bureau of Communicable Diseases. He says a lot has to do with the ability of a patient's immune system to fight off the coronavirus. Westergaard says human-produced proteins, called antibodies, are part of the equation.
In response to any foreign protein, whether it's a bacteria or a virus, the body generally makes antibodies in response. Sometimes those antibodies play a large role in neutralizing the infection and preventing it from doing damage to the body, and sometimes less so. So there are other blood cells called lymphocytes and a whole range of white blood cells that are part of the body's response. There's a lot that we're still learning about why some people have more severe illness.
Some relatives of COVID-19 survivors also credit quick access to high-quality health care, and even some say it's luck when their family members stay alive. But in Wisconsin alone, there are still more than 5,000 active COVID-19 cases, and about 720 people have died. Across the world, more than 450,000 people have passed away. So some researchers are working on ways to heal patients faster or reduce their symptoms. Dr. Amy Jenkins is with the Defense Department's Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, or DARPA. She recently told a webcast offered by the journalism resource group Sideline that DARPA is working on a bigger version of what's being tried in Milwaukee and elsewhere, taking plasma from recovered patients and using those antibodies to help current patients.
That's great. It's not particularly scalable. So you may get, for every person that wants to donate their plasma, you may only be able to treat a handful of people with that plasma. What we want to do is go into that plasma or that blood, find the best antibodies, because not all of them are great, find the ones that are really the good ones, and then manufacture them in large bioreactors off somewhere else and give them back to hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people.
Jenkins says the manufactured antibodies could even be used as a vaccine. Other researchers are also going the large-scale antibody route, and some preliminary test results are due this summer. As many as 150 groups worldwide are working just on potential COVID-19 vaccines. At the UW-Madison, researcher Pete Halfman is part of a team developing what they call CoroFlu, which he says is based on an existing influenza vaccine.
We're taking out one of the proteins or one of the genes of coronavirus and putting it into a vaccine vector that's already going through phase two clinical trials in Europe as a flu vaccine. So we have some efficacy and we have some safety data for this platform that we're using. Now we went ahead and just modified the platform, so now it will also target coronavirus. So it kind of gives us a leg up.
Halfman says more work is ahead and human testing is still 6 months away. He says other vaccines are likely to be ready first, but he says there may be a role for CoroFlu.
As vaccines come out, we're going to see what's working and what doesn't work, and we can, you know, try to modify our vaccine to fill in the parts that other vaccines are not working for.
The Trump administration's COVID-19 vaccine effort, called Operation Warp Speed, hopes to roll out a vaccine by the end of the year. Some scientists and Democrats are skeptical. In Shorewood, Bubbler Talk questioner Gene Kelber says he'll keep his fingers crossed, but in the meantime, make sure friends and family practice social distancing. Chuck Quernbach, 89.7, WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Support for Bubbler Talk comes from SunBadger Solar. What have you always wanted to know about the Milwaukee area? Visit WUWM.com/bubblertalk to submit your question.
You're listening to Lake Effect Weekend. I'm Joy Powers. We'll take a quick break, then look at a Wisconsin Policy Forum report on the gender wage gap. Lake Effect Weekend continues in just a moment on WUWM. Weekend continues now on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers. Over the last couple decades, the gender pay gap has been narrowing nationwide, but it still remains a very real problem. A new report from the Wisconsin Policy Forum has found that here in Milwaukee, women make around 85 cents for every dollar that a man makes. In Waukesha County, it's just 76 cents to every dollar made by a man. This disparity has a lot of consequences, and it often stems from a lot of different factors based on our cultural perceptions of gender roles. Betsy Miller and Joe Pietrangelo are the authors of the report titled Milwaukee's Gender Pay Gap Narrows But Persists, and they join me from their homes to talk about it. When we look at the hard numbers in this report, obviously they have to be contextualized, but overall, without going into different factors outside of gender, what does the disparity look like here in Milwaukee County?
Overall, when we look at the median annual earnings of women compared to men, the median among women is about 85% the median among men. That's when we look at all workers who work full-time. It's different depending on what occupation you're looking at, but that's sort of the big picture view of it. So 85% in Milwaukee County, that's compared to 76% in Waukesha County and 79% nationally. So the gap is actually a little bit smaller in Milwaukee County than it is nationally, and we can get into understanding that a little bit better.
Yeah, let's dig into some of the different factors. What does the disparity look like when we account for race? That seems to have a big impact.
The data we had wasn't able to get at the level of race and gender by occupation, for example, so we couldn't get to that level. But when we look at national data, we see that Black, Hispanic, and American Indian women earn the lowest median incomes overall. So it's particularly a challenge. The gap is then bigger between women in some of those groups or all of those groups than they are among men overall. So the gap is just that much more difficult to close.
Yeah, unfortunately, that data wasn't available at the local level. It would have been really great to see that. But when you break down all of these categories, the number of people is just so small that sometimes it's not available. So,
well, I think that gets to a bigger question about these kinds of reports. I think invariably there's a group of people who wants to cast doubt on any study that points to gender or racial inequities. How are these kinds of reports compiled? What is the kind of data that you used to create this research?
So the data that we used in this report is from the census. The American Community Survey is the yearly sort of larger survey that goes with the census. So Census Bureau data, which is available on a variety of levels. Here we've got Milwaukee County, which is the smallest one we were looking at in terms of, you know, national, state, county. And then we sort of tried to bring in a little bit of research as well to complement that to show what some of the other factors are that go into the pay gap.
And what are some of those factors?
So we looked at some academic studies. So of course, with something as complex as the pay gap, there are people who spend, you know, their entire academic careers studying this and trying to break down what that is. And we wanted to just provide sort of a high level overview of what some of those factors that go into the pay gap might be. And so that's sort of what we tried to bring into the piece as well as the census data.
So just to take a step back, the purpose of doing this study was to go beyond just looking at that high-level number of what is the, you know, income of women compared to men overall. That was sort of the starting place, but our purpose was to understand that better, to get into the details of what drives it, partly by looking at differences in occupations and how women are more concentrated in certain occupations that pay lower wages, or that women are less represented in some of the highest positions within many occupations, the ones that pay the highest within a given occupation. So we wanted to understand some of those factors, and then also some of the other factors that, you know, go beyond just what occupations women are in and get into things like caregiving. We looked at the fact that women are more likely than men to take time for raising kids or taking care of other family members and how that plays into it, and gender discrimination, which you mentioned. We wanted to kind of give a big picture look at many of the factors because it's a very complicated picture.
It is a complicated picture. And I think when you read the report, it shows just how complicated that looks. And one of the things that you do is you created a number of charts that looks at different professions and how job choice, the kinds of professions that women tend to go into, how that can account for some of this disparity. What does that look like? How does that play out?
There are differences in where women are more and less represented, like I mentioned, in different occupational groups. So, for example, we found that women are very underrepresented in architecture and engineering and computer and mathematical occupations. Those are a couple examples of occupations that pay pretty high salaries and that women are still really underrepresented. It's only 20-21% of people in those occupations from Milwaukee County are women. And you have some occupations like healthcare support and office and administrative support that employ large numbers of women, and women are dominate in those fields, but they pay low wages, relatively low wages. Those are some of the examples. And then within certain occupations, like, for example, when we looked at the legal occupation, the biggest gap in Milwaukee County in terms of what women make versus men is in legal occupations. So that is driven by the fact that women are very underrepresented as judges and lawyers. And most of the people who work in legal support occupations, so some of the lower wage occupations within the legal field, are women. So that kind of division leads to this pay gap within that occupation. So that's just an example of the way this plays out throughout the economy.
Yeah, you mapped out what those disparities looked like inside of different occupational groups. You mentioned legal, which was pretty shocking to look at. So the reason it seems that there are these big disparities inside of each of these groups is because of the kinds of positions people tend to hold inside of, you know, the legal profession or healthcare or, you know, education.
That's definitely one factor, you know, in many fields is like I said, that in some cases, women are underrepresented in some of the highest paying positions within them. Another example was management occupation. So women in general are pretty equally represented as managers of all kinds. But when you look at top executives, only 37% of top executives are women. So that when you look at the overall pay gap, women are only making about 80% of what men are overall among people in management. So that's an example. But then those other factors that we discussed help to drive that. Things like women taking more time out of their careers are more likely to take time out for caregiving, and also, you know, gender discrimination and other factors.
Well, and that gets to another thing the report looks at, of course, is the social expectations that are placed on women. Caregiving being just one of them, but something that can have a pretty disproportionate impact on their income. What are some of these social forces that account for the disparities we see play out?
We tried to include just sort of an overview of what these are, and of course, it's hard to say exactly how much each contributes to the wage gap. So we talked about caregiving, which includes sort of women might be more likely to choose to work part-time than men, which our data looked at full-time workers. But if you include part-time workers, that would be a whole other universe of workers. Just to allow for, you know, more greater flexibility within their schedules and to balance their work and their home responsibilities.
We also talk about how there's been an evolution over time in terms of what occupations women are represented in or where they're evenly represented in. And there are still some gaps, like I mentioned, things like architecture and engineering. So there are differences in what men and women have perceived to be good career choices or appropriate career choices for them. And that's been changing over time, but it hasn't completely changed throughout all jobs where women are equally represented with men in every field.
You know, there are a lot of analyses on the amount of emotional labor, but also just physical labor in the form of housework and child rearing after work and the variety of things that come with taking care of a home that will show women are spending a very disproportionate amount of their free time, quote unquote free time, I suppose, working versus men. But it feels like such an intangible kind of thing and a really difficult thing to kind of grasp how it impacts our work. How do you incorporate that into a report?
Mm-hmm. And there are studies that try to quantify, you know, what percent of the gap is due to which factors, and reasonable people disagree on what those numbers are. But I think what generally is agreed on in the academic research is that it's a very complex issue and there's a lot of factors that go into it. And so in creating a solution, you have to find solutions that are equally complex to address the issue.
And somehow intersectional?
Yes.
So the gap is narrowing a bit here, but at what pace?
So in Milwaukee County, we compared 2010 to 2018, and we saw that the gap narrowed from women earning 81% of what men earned to 85% during that period. So there was some closing of the gap. We also saw that it had closed in Waukesha County. It had closed from 70 to 76%, and then nationally from 77 to 79%. So there is a slow closing of the gap, and that's only looking over an 8-year period. But there's also evidence that it's slowing somewhat. At least a lot of national research says that the closing of the gap is starting to slow down. And so there's no guarantee that it'll continue to close at the same pace. Initial data is showing that women are more likely than men to have lost their job due to the pandemic. And so there's a chance that that could make the pay gap actually worse over time. So that's concerning. But then on the other hand, we don't know exactly how this is going to play out. And a possible silver lining of all of this is that in a lot of different occupations, new work structures and schedules have come about, more people working from home, more flexible schedules. And a lot of the research shows that those are the things that often drive women to choose certain fields or not choose certain fields, is the lack of flexibility in their schedules. And so that is something that if that is continues, at least in those fields that have started to have more flexibility, it might actually help to narrow the gap in the long term.
All right. Well, Betsy, Joe, thank you both so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Betsy Miller is a researcher and Joe Pietrangelo is a senior researcher at the Wisconsin Policy Forum. Their recent report titled Milwaukee's Gender Pay Gap Narrows But Persists can be found at wispolicyforum.org. We'll take one last break, then take a virtual tour of the Milwaukee Public Museum when Lake Effect Weekend returns in just a moment on WUWM. You're listening to Lake Effect Weekend on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers. Many organizations are finding new ways to engage with the public during this pandemic. Like most places, the Milwaukee Public Museum has remained closed. But a new partnership with Google is allowing people back inside the museum without leaving their homes. One of the Google Maps' best-known features is called Street View, which allows people to zoom in on a location and see on-the-ground photos. Now you can do the same with the Public Museum's Streets of Old Milwaukee or its Living Ocean exhibits. Jenny Tetzloff is the Milwaukee Public Museum's Director of Integrated Marketing, and she joins Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski to explain more about the project. She begins by explaining how the partnership between the museum and Google began.
Our director of electronic systems and information, Greg Post, has been in contact with Google since 2014, actually, to get this up and running. And Google came out and they took some photos, and then there was, I guess, some sort of technical glitch on that end. So they came back out just as we were wrapping up our Hidden Wisconsin exhibit, which was a temporary exhibit we did in 2016, 2017. So we were able to get that photographed. And Greg has been working with them to do a lot of different things regarding the museum. And he has been able to push this forward. Once we closed, he got back to them and said, hey, it would be really great. You know, I know we have these photos and we've been going back and forth, but it would be great for the community to be able to see everything while we're closed. And he was able to push that forward.
So you mentioned Google was coming and taking photographs. Can you explain the technical process? Was it, you know, we think of Google Street View satellite images as the car with the big 360 camera going around. So what did it look like to capture the museum in this way?
So they did have three staff members from Google come out with photographers, and they took pictures of everything kind of in a 360 kind of way. And they were able to get a lot of our photos and put those together on their end in the technical way, so to speak.
You mentioned there was a Hidden Wisconsin exhibit in 2016 that we could view right now. Are there any other exhibits or things that were at the museum previously during this time that we can now see today that we wouldn't be able to had museum operations been in normal circumstances?
No, for the most part, many of our exhibits are still the same as they were in 2016. But the Hidden Wisconsin exhibit is really cool because it has a lot of different artifacts and objects and specimens from all over Wisconsin that we don't usually have out, either because they are too fragile to be out or they're used mainly for research purposes. And so it's really nice that the community can come back and see those artifacts and specimens and look at them.
On the note of artifacts and specimens, I know a lot of your collection is vastly in storage. So during this time, have you been able to really go through all of the artifacts and kind of regroup and see what you have, what the public hasn't seen, and use this time in a way that will still serve the museum even though people can't come in the doors?
Yes. Our curatorial team has been able to go in, and we always have to manage collections. There are certain temperatures and certain standards that you have to meet. And so our curatorial team is full of amazing people who have been in the museum on and off. I mean, for the most part, most of us are working from home, but they do go in to check specimens. We do have security on staff, making sure that if anything should happen, they can get out and make sure that all of those objects and artifacts and specimens are safe.
So what are the most important aspects of a strategy that you had to develop in order to adapt to the coronavirus? You know, and what other ways are you engaging with visitors during this time?
For us, I would say that the most important thing that we've been doing is really moving into digital resources. So what we started to do is our education team and our curatorial team and a bunch of our other teams have come together, and we have created a weekly newsletter that we send out to people that gives activities that you can do for both children and adults. It highlights different collections. Some of them are on exhibit, but as you said, many of our collections are not on exhibit. And so some of them highlight things that you can't even see, and really moving into the digital realm, be it in, you know, video format. We're going to be doing a breakfast with the curators video. So that's really exciting. And just moving into a digital format so that we can still stay in touch with the community and make sure that they are getting access to really what is their collections.
So down the road, when time does come to reopen, you know, how have you been planning for that? You know, how will the experience for people be different? And I imagine you're working with city and county and health officials to find out the best way to go about things. So what has been at the forefront of your mind and in your planning?
So we do have a reopening committee that has been working with not only other museums in Wisconsin, but also with city and county and state health officials to make sure that everything is safe. I can't really say what that experience is going to look like yet, because we're still working through all those processes, and we're going to When we can open our doors, I can promise it's going to be a very safe experience for everyone, and you're still going to be able to enjoy all of the objects and exhibits that you've come to enjoy. It'll be a little different, but we're going to make sure it's as smooth as it can possibly be, and definitely the safety of our visitors and our staff is really important to us.
You know, I think fondly upon the time I've been able to go to the museum, whether it's through school or with family, and with that experience just on hold for a little bit, you know, what's one exhibit or perhaps a favorite object of yours that you can recommend to us to look for while taking a virtual tour online?
Well, for me, I love the Crossroads of Civilization exhibit that is on the third floor. We opened that in 2015. We have a Cleopatra coin that I always think is really kind of cool. It's like one of the first female leaders. She has her face on currency, and she's being a strong woman. So I enjoy that one.
Being able to step in front of an artifact such as that, you know, is a crucial point of that museum experience, right? But, you know, do you think museums will have to change the classic brick and mortar model as we adapt from this pandemic? And, you know, it's obviously hard to tell what's going to happen in the future, but now there needs to be a lot of other plans in place, a lot of other measures at the ready.
Sure, but I do think that for museums, like objects and specimens and artifacts are a big part of what we do. And so, like, I cannot foresee a future where those items are never going to be at the forefront, because we all have the internet now. We can all go on and look at a picture of something that you can see somewhere else, but there's a different experience when it's directly in front of you. Yes, it may not be the same in terms of tactile experiences and touching. I don't know what that's going to look like yet, but I mean, I think that we will always be a museum where there are objects and specimens and things that you wouldn't ordinarily be able to see in front of you, for sure.
So I know the museum also had a plan in place to build and move to a new space. Obviously, the pandemic disrupts things greatly on all fronts. So do you think this will still be able to happen at some point in the future? What's the museum's goal in working towards that?
Absolutely. They are still moving forward with that initiative. And, you know, we're going to be able to learn a lot of new things about what the future should look like based on what we're going through right now.
Well, Jenny Tetzlaff, thank you so much for your time today, and we look forward to exploring the museum online until we can return again.
Thank you.
Jenny Tetzlaff is the Milwaukee Public Museum's Director of Integrated Marketing, and she spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski. And that wraps up today's show. I'm Joy Powers. Thank you so much for making us a part of your afternoon. Lake Effect Weekend airs every Saturday and Sunday from 3 to 4 on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.